This is Christopher Muth, Associate Editor at JAMA, and I'm talking with Dr. Holly Prigerson, who wrote a chapter entitled Caring for Bereaved Patients in JAMA Evidence, Care at the Close of Life. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Prigerson. Can you please tell us about yourself?
My name is Holly Gwen Prigerson. I'm a professor of medicine at Weill Cornell Medicine and co-director of the Center for Research on End-of-Life Care at Cornell University. And I'm the Irving Sherwood Wright Professor of Geriatrics.
So you mentioned in your chapter that bereavement, or grieving the loss of a loved one, is quite common. And physicians are probably frequently encountering patients who are grieving, although they may not always know it. How common is bereavement, and why is it important for physicians to be aware that patients they're caring for might be grieving?
Bereavement is very common because bereavement is the reaction to the loss of a significant other. So whenever there's a death, assuming someone has significant others, that is a spouse or a partner, a child, a parent, any one of those individuals is likely to be significantly affected by the loss of that person, the death of that person. So as common as death is, assuming someone has significant attachments, they'll be survived by people who will experience grief in response to that loss. That's what bereavement is. The normal response to grief is being upset and missing the person, feeling sad. But we've done lots of studies that try to identify when the path to adjustment hits a bump in the road and when people get stuck. And that can also be common in a significant minority of bereaved survivors.
What are some of the symptoms or the manifestations of bereavement?
The manifestations of bereavement include symptoms and experiences like missing the person, yearning and pining and longing for the person, feeling that your emotional connection with others is no longer as close as it used to be, feeling mistrust of others, feeling unsure of who you are and what your role in the family, at work, or in the larger society is, feeling a part of you died along with the deceased. Those are some of the key signs and symptoms of what we call prolonged grief disorder. And many of these symptoms and experiences, particularly the yearning and pining for the deceased, are highly prevalent, highly common in people after they lose someone that they love. That's a normal, natural thing. But what we've shown repeatedly, and it's been demonstrated worldwide, is that by 6 months after the death of someone, the vast majority of people feel some resolution in the intensity of the pangs of grief and some return to feeling that they can enjoy things again and less distressed to the extent that they were initially.
Is there a typical course for normal grief?
We've studied the stages of grief and how people resolve the indicators of grief over time, such as they call it DABDA. So it's disbelief, anger, bargaining in the case of pre-loss death, depression, and then ultimately acceptance, or what we prefer to call resignation to the new normal, your new life without this person. For people who don't meet criteria for prolonged grief disorder, people don't usually march in lockstep and follow that DABDA stage theory of grief necessarily, but there are certain universal truths, which is that most people feel in a state of shock, disbelief, or emotional numbness immediately after someone they love has died. And the other truism is that gradually over time, the pain gets lessened and ameliorated and adjustment increases and acceptance grows. But what we find with people who meet criteria for prolonged grief disorder is that they get stuck and they don't resolve their grief in that way. So there's a distinction between normal grief and pathological grief in terms of the intensity and duration of symptoms, and largely that notion of getting stuck in a state of chronic mourning.
And you've mentioned prolonged grief disorder a few times now. So what is it exactly?
Prolonged grief disorder is the reaction to the death of a significant other that's characterized primarily by feelings of intense yearning, pining, and longing for the deceased person beyond 6 months post-loss, and mostly those symptoms are associated with significant functional impairment. There's other additional symptoms required that could include symptoms such as feeling that a part of you died, feeling emotionally detached, feeling that life has lost its meaning. There are about 9 other symptoms that can add to the mix, but if you had to distill to its essential issue, the essential issue is this intense longing and yearning and pining for the deceased person.
How common is prolonged grief disorder?
After 6 months, intense yearning is a highly predictive indicator of who's not going to adjust well and who's going to be stuck in a state of chronic mourning. And believe it or not, we do prevalence studies. It's only about 7% of national samples. In China, it's as low as like 3%. Using those criteria, very few people yearn that intensely beyond 6 months in the context of the death of an older person from natural causes in later life.
For a modern-day practicing clinician, if they're seeing a patient who is bereaved, what they would want to be thinking about is this patient experiencing a normal grief process, or are they experiencing prolonged grief?
Exactly. And it's pretty simple. Are they yearning intensely to the point where they're not functioning well?
Okay. So I want to talk a little bit now about what physicians can do to engage with bereaved patients. There were a few different scenarios that you mentioned in the chapter when physicians might encounter people who are grieving. So for example, a doctor might be caring for a patient who passes away in the hospital, and then the doctor will interact then with the deceased patient's family or friends. So that'd be one. Or another one would be a doctor might just be seeing a patient in his or her clinic who is bereaved after they recently lost a loved one. So if we talk about just the first scenario first, so when a physician is caring for a patient and that patient passes away, can you offer advice about how a physician might approach the patient's family members?
We've been doing lots of studies and are trying to develop interventions, including interventions in the ICU, where death of a patient is very common, and physicians are interacting with bereft family members who are in a state of shock, disbelief, and numbness. And one of the things that we're working on actually is a little bit upstream of that. For patients who are in the ICU, for example, or in the emergency room, one of the things that we're finding is that a lot of the patients can't communicate right before they die. And we've been doing studies that show that they actually have pre-loss grief. They have anticipatory grief and are intensely sad about what's going on. So on some level, the family member in the ICU who's watching their loved one die, witnessing it, is struggling with trying to understand what's happening. And we found that there's experiential avoidance, and that gets at their reluctance to even engage in discussions of do not resuscitate orders or thinking about planning for the future. So we're developing interventions to try to help the staff in the hospital deal with the family member and approach them in a way that helps address their concerns and fears and worries about the patient's impending death. So prophylactically, it might be helpful for clinical staff, not just the physicians, but any clinician who's witnessing this family member about to become bereaved, to anticipate that, name it, and recognize that they are struggling with an actual death, rather than what I've heard oftentimes is the opposite, where no one says a word, everyone acts like they might pull through. There might be additional tests that could be performed where there's this sort of lack of recognition of what's going on. So the first thing I'd recommend to physicians and intensivists and other staff members in the hospital is it would be very helpful, we're finding, for the family member to have some recognition on the part of the physician and the care team that there is a high probability that the patient might die, to give them some preparation for what's about to happen. Then one of the other concerns that I've heard from the family members after the patients died is that a lot of family members feel abandoned by their physicians after the patient dies. And that happens in the hospital, and I studied cancer patients a lot, and that happens with their oncologist, where as the patient starts declining, if the patient's been sent to hospice and then dies in hospice, the bereaved family members, they feel abandoned by the care team. The hospice does a bereavement follow-up, but for the oncologist, I hear from the surviving family members, the bereaved surviving family members, that they would have appreciated a condolence note naming the name of the person who died, if possible, saying that it was an honor to care for this person, that they appreciated getting to know this person, and acknowledgement of loss rather than ignoring it, avoiding it, avoiding the bereaved person because it's considered, in some sense, the failure of medicine to have kept this person alive. That's not what the family's feeling. The family's feeling that they want the life of their loved one to have been recognized and the death acknowledged by the attending physicians. I don't think physicians realize that every single decision that was made that led up to the death, either in the hospital or at home, is a movie that's played over and over again in the minds of the bereaved family members. So they are going through all the sins of omission and the sins of commission, like what was done, why it was done, in order to sort of circumvent the Groundhog Day repeating of what happened over and over and feeling potentially guilty or regretting what they did or didn't do. It might be helpful for them to have an opportunity to ask people who cared for the patient as they were dying very specific questions that are playing over and over in their minds about whether they did the right thing or not. Because on some level, they want to hear that they didn't fail the patient in meeting their healthcare needs.
And how about another scenario? So now if a doctor is caring for a patient in clinic who may have recently lost a loved one, can you offer some general recommendations for how clinicians might begin to talk about grief with a patient in that situation?
Right. Like, I think we began this conversation with you saying how common is bereavement and how would physician know if their patient is bereaved? And the simple answer is ask them, especially in geriatrics. Bereavement's not a rare event. And especially as patients get older, older patients encounter loss almost on a daily basis. So if a physician were to just ask one question about, have you experienced a significant loss to you as someone very close to you died recently, can you tell me about that? That would be a way to take a read on, A, if they are grieving, and B, how much that loss is potentially affecting them.
And I think at least some physicians are a little bit uncertain about how to figure those things out. So let's say that they've inquired and the patient has replied that, yes, they have experienced a loss of a significant other recently. What are some of the next types of questions that a clinician might think about asking?
So it's pretty straightforward. To what extent do you yearn or pine or long for that person who died on a daily basis? How long ago did it happen? And how much are you yearning? Like every day, do you have intrusive thoughts about this person that upset you? To what extent have feeling upset and missing this person, how much does that affect your ability to interact with others? Are you feeling lonely? Does the loss of this person in your life affect your social functioning, your ability to go out and, you know, enjoy yourself with your friends and family members? How does it affect your mood, your sleeping, your eating, any exercise? Was this attachment so close to you that you were yearning and pining to have this person back because your life is just never going to be the same and it's been totally disrupted? And then finding out if yes, the extent to the disruption, and if yes to that, then they should be referred to a mental health professional who knows about helping people with prolonged grief disorder. Since there is a strong link between prolonged grief disorder and suicidal ideation and substance abuse in people or patients who consume a lot of alcohol or drink or smoke or use a lot of drugs, we find that if they're bereaved and really yearning and pining and self-medicating with alcohol, for example, they are at very high risk of suicide. So you want to just probe and make sure that they're not either passively or actively suicidal.
And I want to talk a little bit more about depression. At one point, I think, in the DSM, it said that you can't be diagnosed with depression if you've recently experienced the loss of a loved one. So, can depression be diagnosed in the context of bereavement?
Yes. There had been a raging debate on what they call the bereavement exclusion in the DSM. So there was a vote to remove the exclusion, which, to summarize, it just basically said that within 2 months of the death of a lifelong partner, you could be diagnosed with major depressive disorder if you met the criteria. And I have problems with that because there have been studies that have shown that the people who would meet criteria 2 months after the death are not necessarily the same people who meet criteria 6 months after the death, and that it's premature to start diagnosing feeling sad and blue and maybe a weight loss and some of the symptoms and lack of interest in things within 2 months after the death of a significant other. That would be a false positive. And as bereavement researchers, given just how common bereavement is in everyone's life, we are very concerned and hyper-focused on false positives and focus more on specificity rather than sensitivity of making that kind of diagnosis. And it seems to me a slippery slope and conflict of interest when some of the advocates for removing the exclusion have psychotherapies to offer those recently bereaved and or drugs. So those conflicts of interest are real, and especially in the context of bereavement, which is such a normal, common event, you don't want to be pathologizing normal people and saying that they're depressed when they're just going through a hard time that anyone would experience, and that will resolve with time and without professional intervention.
So when can or should depression be diagnosed in the context of bereavement, in your opinion?
To us, our data seem to suggest that for the average person, by 4 to 6 months after the death, there's starting to be some movement in terms of starting to feel a little bit better. And if by 6 months after the death, someone met diagnostic criteria for major depressive disorder, that seems like a fair time to say, you know what, time alone is not going to heal this wound. We need professional intervention.
And in terms of the management or treatment of depression, is the management different depending on whether or not the person is currently experiencing bereavement?
There's been a debate in psychiatry about endogenous versus exogenous depression. Like, is this person biologically, for whatever reason, predisposed to be depressed, and is it less about the recent insult or trigger or stressor that resulted in a full episode of major depression? Regardless of how you get to meeting diagnostic criteria for the disorder, it could be post-traumatic stress disorder or prolonged grief disorder or major depressive disorder. If it's truly that this person was very close to the one who died and their life has been disrupted and they're finding it very difficult to function as a result of this loss, I would think psychotherapeutically you'd have to address that. Interpersonal psychotherapy, acceptance and commitment therapy, cognitive behavioral therapies, these are pretty well-established therapies, and I've been involved with we're developing an online CBT-based intervention for free that we've published data that from an NIMH-funded study that shows that this online intervention, logging on 3 times a week and performing these cognitive behavioral exercises of getting a bereaved person re-engaged with others, that is very effective at reducing depression, anxiety, grief in people who were struggling in the immediate post-loss period.
And then medications like antidepressants could be used as well, or even in combination with psychotherapy. Is that right, for someone who's experiencing depression with bereavement?
Yes, I think Chip Reynolds, 1999, I think, published in JAMA Psychiatry an analysis of data that showed that combination interpersonal psychotherapy with, I think at the time it was nortriptyline, that resulted in 69% remission from a major depressive episode. So, I think therapy in combination with an antidepressant has been shown to be effective among patients who have bereavement-related depression.
And what is the treatment for someone who has prolonged grief disorder but does not have depression?
There have been several cognitive behavioral therapy-based interventions, acceptance and commitment therapy-based interventions that have been published that show that they are significantly effective for reducing prolonged grief disorder and depression and anxiety in bereaved patients, both young and old. So Kathy Shear has published, she calls it complicated grief therapy. Richard Bryant has published results of, he calls it prolonged grief therapy. We've published results of an online intervention for prolonged grief disorder. Paul Bullen in the Netherlands has published data showing cognitive behavioral therapy-based treatments for prolonged grief disorder. So there are effective treatments that are available now.
Okay, and when should a referral to a psychiatrist be considered?
After 6 months, if a person meets criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder, prolonged grief disorder, or major depressive disorder, those would represent conditions for making a referral to a psychiatrist. One of the, seems like, misconceptions is that prolonged grief disorder is the normal reaction and major depressive disorder is the real psychiatric reaction. And our data and data from lots of people really show that's not the case. If anything, prolonged grief disorder is a bigger risk factor for poor adjustment, for substance abuse, for suicidal ideation, for hospitalization. So it's not that major depressive disorder is the pathology and that grief is not the pathology. The grief per se is a risk for a lot of health problems and functional impairments, more so than major depressive disorder. So that's sort of what we've been trying to demonstrate with data. Now others are demonstrating it way more than we are. So I think that's a pretty well-established thing, is that severe grief that's prolonged is functionally impairing and a risk for health impairments and worthy of intervention and treatment.
Thank you very much for speaking with us, Dr. Prigerson. You've been listening to Chapter 25, Caring for Bereaved Patients, from JAMA Evidence, Care at the Close of Life. This is Christopher Muth, Associate Editor at JAMA, with this JAMA Evidence podcast.